in these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there, my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are Charles Baxter and Maria Hornbacher, author of Madness. First up is Charles Baxter. He was born in Minneapolis and graduated from McAllister College in St. Paul. After completing graduate work in English at the State University of New York at Buffalo, he taught several years at Wayne State University in Detroit. In 1989, he moved to the Department of English at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and its MFA program. He now teaches at the University of Minnesota. Charles is the author of four novels, four collections of short stories, three collections of poems, a wonderful collection of essays on fiction called Burning Down the House, and a recent book called The Art of Subtext by Grey Wolf. His most recent novel is The Soul Thief, published by Pantheon. Let's bring him on. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you on the show. I've been aware of your work for quite some time, and most recently read The Soul Thief and was so impressed and so curious as to what inspired the novel. Would you talk about that?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. The novel really came out of a confluence of causes. The first one being that many years ago, almost three decades now, when I was first getting my start as a writer, I had a friend to whom I was in those days sending my work, who I discovered later was going around claiming to be Charles Baxter and claiming to have written my work. And the circumstances of that were so strange that it took me almost three decades before I could figure out a way to get that story into a book. But the second story, or the second thing that happened to me, was that a friend told me about her freshman year at Duke University when her roommate began to steal her clothes and to imitate her gestures and to pick up her habits of speech. And she thought, that's very odd. And lastly, I became interested in the last, three or four years in the way that identities these days are being formed by young people in such places as Facebook and MySpace. And I thought, well, you know, I suppose most of the time these identities are real, but sometimes they are probably virtual. That is, there's a degree to which identities are becoming fictionalized and publicized. And when I had that idea, I thought, well, maybe it's time for me to sit down and write this book. So it was really those three things that got me started.
Interesting. So is that how your fiction tends to come about? Things happen. You store them somewhere in your brain, in a journal, in a notebook, whatever, and at some point they come out, or do they begin all sorts of ways?
Well, a friend of mine says that I have the habit of putting subjects away the way you put blue cheese into a cave until it's ready. I prefer the metaphor of percolating, that it has to percolate for a while before I'm ready to write about it. Like many writers, I suppose I'm a bit of a daydreamer, and I have to have some sense, I have to daydream my way through a book until I have a fairly clear sense of where it's going to go and what it's going to do. I hate sitting in front of a typewriter or a computer keyboard or a blank sheet of paper not quite knowing where it's going to go. I like discovering some things, but I have to have some other areas mapped out before I can start.
So does that mean you'll do an outline of some sort or write down a plot or synopsis?
I used to write outlines. I used to have a very clear sense of the plot and the synopsis of the story, but I found that took away too much of the excitement of discovery while I was actually working. So now I start start with what I know, and then I sail off in the direction of what I have to discover about the story.
Hmm. So with The Soul Thief, were there surprises? Did you end up somewhere other than you thought you would end up at the end?
No, I had the ending all planned out. There's a bit of a surprise, which should not be a surprise to the reader at the end of the book, and I had that one mostly, or I didn't have it mostly, I had it completely thought out. What I hadn't quite figured out was how I was going to stage some of the book. I had to fly to Buffalo, New York, and drive up to Niagara Falls to discover whether one of the scenes I had staged there could actually happen in the way that I said it would. And I got a park ranger to assure me that, in fact, it could happen that way.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Charles Baxter. His most recent novel is The Soul Thief. I was curious about the point of view, because the book begins in the first person, and it goes into third person, and then back, the last bit of the book is back in first person again. New writers especially, I think, wonder often about the rules in switching point of view, as well as chapter length, because it seems that your chapter, the number of pages vary. Some chapters are one page long, and new writers also hear, you know, be consistent, you know, novels should have long chapters. Could you talk a little bit about both of these things, point of view and chapter construction?
Yes. Well, to start with point of view, I think it's often the case that when we begin a novel with a first-person narrator, we think that person is really there. There's somebody there who is generating these sentences. I did this, I did that. There must be somebody who's being represented by this first-person pronoun. But, of course, that's to some degree a fiction. In fiction, and in a novel about identity, which this one is, I wanted to keep myself, first of all, and the reader, secondly, somewhat off balance, and for the reader to close the book and to think, well, you know, the I was not or is not quite the person or persons I thought it was. You know, as I get older, I like to take more chances with these things. When I was a younger writer, I had a much more solid sense of the I than I do now. And as for the chapter lengths, that is also something that I felt I wanted to experiment with, because in some ways this is a white space narrative book. There are a lot of gaps in it. A lot of what James Agee once called expressive air pockets of dead silence. and I wanted to write those expressive air pockets of dead silence into the text somehow. So the reader who is, you know, turning the pages and expecting to find a long chapter may find it, but he or she may also come upon a chapter that stops at exactly the point when you thought it was going to continue.
Mm. That's a great explanation of both of those things, actually. Yeah. So much to cover in this half hour, so I'm sort of skipping around. In chapter 37, you have written, I think, one of the most stunning descriptions of Los Angeles that I've ever read. your poetry, I know you are or were a poet, and it shows throughout the prose in this book, but especially in this chapter, so much great description. The line, "The night dropped its black lace around us," that I think that's around chapter 37 onward, and it's wonderful. And as I was reading it, I was wondering whether you'd spent much time out here, because it seemed to me that the description was so detailed, almost from the point of view of someone who has only visited briefly and could pick it up and know exactly what this is out here.
Well, I like to say to my students that one of the best ways to describe anything is to position yourself as a stranger to what you're looking at. And I've been to Los Angeles many, many times and have spent quite a bit of time there, but I've always felt myself to be a stranger there. I think there's so much in Los Angeles that the person who lives there takes for granted that I wanted to bring in the beauty of the place, but also the way that the details of the landscape can seem very odd at certain times of year if you're not used to them.
Mm-hmm.
Starting at LAX and moving on to Sunset Boulevard and the Santa Monica Freeway, and even down to and including the cars that you find on the freeways. So I tried to get as much of that into the book as I could.
You sure did. You sure did.
Thank you.
Again, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Charles Baxter, author of The Soul Thief and many other wonderful books. I'm curious, you write nonfiction as well. You write about writing. Are you working on one project at a time, or will you go back and forth between, say, a novel and a book about writing?
I almost always work on one thing at a time. I'm one of those obsessive characters, obsessive compulsive, I guess. Well, I mean, many writers are. I know one writer who says that it's impossible to write a 200 or 300 page novel unless you're obsessive compulsive. if you're going to keep all those details in their proper order, you have to have some of these features. But in my own case, anyway, I usually have to finish one project before I can take another one up. I had finished the essays in the book Beyond Plot before I could start in on The Soul Thief. And I had to finish The Soul Thief before I could take up the stories and the essays that I've written since then.
Interesting. Okay. Burning Down the House is such a wonderful book about writing fiction. I routinely recommend it to all of my students. You have an essay in this book that I particularly liked, which was called Against Epiphanies. And I'd love to hear what inspired that essay and a capsulized view of what you think of epiphanies, because, again, a lot of new writers are taught, you know, every short story must have an epiphany, every novel must have an epiphany. So talk to us about epiphanies, and also if the epiphany is different in relation to the short stories, the novel.
Right. Well, I've been attacked bitterly by several people for that essay, and I have to say that it arose because of a rejection slip. One of my stories was sent back by an editor, and I think I quoted the editor in the essay. The editor said, there isn't enough insight in this story to justify the amount of, I think he said, experiences that are narrated here. And I thought, that's very odd. Why is it that stories are always expected to have a payoff of insight? And that made me think of my childhood reading of Aesop's Fables and the moral that those fables always end with. And then I began looking around and reading essays that year had appeared in the best American short stories, and I noticed that many of the stories my students were then writing ended with a phrase that was almost always the equivalent of "suddenly I realized." And I thought, you know, there really is nothing wrong with epiphanies. In fact, they're sacred. They are holy. The tradition of the epiphanies is that of a sacred, or an insight into the sacred. And as such, at their best, we should try to keep them sacred. What was happening to the epiphany, though, was that it was being marketed in a way in writing workshops as the way to end a story, and therefore as a form or as an instance, the epiphany was becoming a matter of cliche. So I thought, it's time to put a stop to this. It's time to put a stop to this. I might as well be the bad cop and say that I'm against epiphanies. And I got a lot of angry letters from religious people and from people who felt that I was against insight and against understanding. I'm not. There's nothing I like better than understanding something or having insight into it. But I felt that the whole mode as a trope was being overused.
Yeah, and as I understood it, that an epiphany can be a contrivance, and therefore, you know, just throws the whole story or the whole book off, because it wouldn't happen like that.
Yeah, the old insight train comes chugging in at 4:30 or at the end of the story, and it seems to come out of nowhere, and when it does, it does look contrived. You know, when you read some of the sources of the epiphany in those great stories by James Joyce or by, oh, I don't know, Henry James or Edith Wharton, it never seems to be contrived, and in our own time with, you know, the stories, let's say, of Edward P. Jones, I mean, he writes beautiful stories with often epiphanic closures to them, and they never seem as if they come out of nowhere. They come right out of the character's own situations and their understandings of their lives. They're beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Also, in another book about writing, The Art of Subtext, which I also liked so much, I like everything you have to say about writing, I must say. You talk about genre fiction, and specifically you talk about you say that the techno-thriller and the romance novel, I think, basically serve as antidotes to imagination rather than inspiring it, which is why these types of books make for popular airline reading. That was such a fun section of the book. Will you talk a bit about subtext and even about genre as opposed to literary fiction?
Well, with subtext, I was trying to get at the problem or what it is that we're looking for when we read a work of what we call literature. And I mean, the sense of it is that you're going beyond the plot. The plot is all well and good, but what you're often yearning for in a work of literature is what is unsaid, what is suggested, what seems to rise out of the materials in an almost poetic or lyrical way. And by contrast, I had spent, I mean, an author spends time in airplanes on book tours and so on, and I had spent time in airports, and I noticed that men were often reading Tom Clancy novels and women were often reading Daniel Steele novels. It's strange how gender separations persist in airport reading. I read a couple of these books by both authors, and I thought, you know, these books are really not about the imagination. They're about things. They're about the material world. They're about commodities. They're about objects. And both kinds of books don't ask you to use your imagination. They tell you everything that you need to know as you're reading them. And so although, say, a Tom Clancy novel or a Daniel Steele novel both have intricate plots, they don't generally take you beyond the plot. It's in the plot that you must stay with these books. And in my essays, I was trying to describe something else.
Yes, and you did. So how much plot do you think a literary novel needs?
Well, I was talking to my workshop students about this yesterday, because we got a story into the workshop that was beautifully plotted and was intricately structured. And I said to the workshop students, you know, this is very interesting. There's a protagonist, an antagonist, a conflict, and there's suspense in this story. And the fiction of workshops is that every reader will always read a text to the end, because in a workshop, you have to. It's a requirement of the workshop. But in the real world, readers won't always read your work to the end, and that's why I think workshop teachers sometimes have to bring up the problem of urgency. That is, what makes the events in a story seem urgent? What is going to make the reader think that something is about to happen? And a plot will do that. Now, I don't think all stories need or should be like that. There's no boredom like the boredom of being excited all the time. But I do think that sometimes in writing workshops, we don't think enough about what makes a reader turn the page and keep reading. And that's why I think young writers need to think more about the problem of plot, even if they would rather not. They need to.
Hmm. Interesting. Oh, I regret to say we're at the end of our time. We should have had you on longer. maybe you'll come on again. It's been wonderful talking with you, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
Well, my advice is now what it has always been, which is you have to be stubborn. The writer who succeeds is, after all, the writer who hasn't quit. And, of course, the other advice that I think all writers give young writers is don't just write, read. You know, read everything you possibly can, and read it as a writer reading another writer's work. And good fortune to you.
Mm. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're quite welcome. That was Charles Baxter, author of The Soul Thief, Burning Down the House, The Art of Subtext, Feast of Love, so many books, so much more I wanted to talk with him about. His website is charlesbaxter.com, and there's a wonderful profile of him by Plowshares that I just posted on my blog this morning. If you go to penonfire.com, click on blog at the top of it, it will take you to that posting and to that link. It's so much about him and about the art of writing. So do check it out, and do check out his most recent novel, The Soul Thief. There's so much there. Wonderful, wonderful read. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we will be with Maria Hornbacher, author of Madness. So please stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. You can listen to us via iTunes. Go to iTunes, then radio, and scan down for public radio and KUCI, and we're right there. We also podcast. All of the shows eventually find their way up. I think we have 250 plus at this point in April of 2008. So what you need to do is go to my website, penonfire.com, go to the radio page. You'll find it by clicking on the radio tower on the left side of the page. And at the top of the radio page, there are instructions for listening to all the past shows, free of charge, anytime you like. This one should go up in the next next couple of weeks, most likely. In any case, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I was with Charles Baxter during the first half of the show, and I am back now with Maria Hornbacher. She's here to talk about madness, and her first memoir actually was Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia, which HarperCollins published in 1998 when she was 23. And she says what started as a crazy idea by writer friend became a classic book that's been published in 14 languages, is taught in universities and writing programs and all over the world. And it has brought her quite a bit of acclaim and thousands of letters from people who say that book changed their lives. Her second book was the novel The Center of Winter by HarperCollins in 2005. And again, her new memoir is Madness, A Life, published by Houghton Mifflin. And it's about the difficulties and promise of living with mental illness. And I'm going to bring her on. Maria, hello.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show.
Great to be here.
Will you talk a little bit about madness and what inspired you to write this book?
I think there were a couple of things. First of all, just speaking as a writer, it's a good story. I'm really a sucker for writing a good story. It's also obviously a story pretty close to my heart. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder years after I began experiencing it, and so much is still misperceived about mental illness, about bipolar disorder. I knew so little about it when I was diagnosed. People still have such misperceptions about people with any form of mental illness that I really thought what I wanted to do was bring people inside the mind of someone with a severe mental illness and say, oh my gosh, look around, it's still a regular person. You know, it's still a thinking, interesting, breathing, living person, and not some sort of foreign entity that we can't any of us understand. So I wanted to tell a good story with that point.
It's interesting what you say about story, because I think it's such an important thing to remember with memoir, which is that it can't be simply about your life. It has to be a good story.
Absolutely. I think when I talk to students or groups about writing memoir, I mean, the first thing everybody says is, you know, how much can you editorialize or how much can you fictionalize? And I go, none. You know, your basic point here is nonfiction is nonfiction. The second thing I say is the most important person in writing a memoir is not you, it's your reader. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't write a book to cathart. I don't write a book. You know, I have a great therapist for that. I have no need to get it all out on paper and then publish it, for heaven's sakes. What I'm trying to do when I write a memoir, you know, as you know, this is my second memoir, is the same thing I'm trying to do when I write a novel, which is reach a reader, you know, where they live. I think about the reader sitting in their armchair or on their bus with the book in their hands, and I want to touch them. It is not serve me at all to put a book out there that doesn't serve someone else. And my interest, you know, as any writer, my interest is in touching somebody deeply, intellectually and emotionally, and that's what I try to do whether I'm writing a memoir or whether I'm writing fiction.
So do you structure the memoir? Do you plot it out? Do you know what's going to go where when you begin?
I do. You know, I think anyone writing a lengthy thing realizes that knowing what you know at the beginning when you're so sure you know what you're doing is nothing like what you wind up with at the end. And so my outlines initially are probably totally useless, but they get me to where I'm going. So I do outline the plot. I mean, you know, I think at heart I'm a novelist. I'm working on a new novel now, and that's the most familiar and comfortable form for me. And so I plot it out like a novel, like I would any other, you know, piece of nonfiction even. I can't just start spreeing off with my own thoughts. I think when I initially get an idea, I start jotting things down. I jot down maybe a scene, maybe a couple of pages, maybe a chapter, and I go, okay, where do I want to go from here? What is the story underlying this? And then I start outlining. I start saying, okay, where do I want to begin? Where do I want to go with this? What's the crisis point? Where are the pages in between? What do I want to achieve stylistically? What do I want to achieve in terms of getting a point across? And so it is pretty calibrated when I start writing, and then you know it, the writing just takes over, and you have to step back every now and then and rein it back in, and eventually you come up with a book, and then the big project of writing a book is editing it. cutting it and getting it down to size and getting it to be really exactly what you're trying to say. So
with Madness, then, how much did you cut? I mean, how did the first draft differ from what we read in the book in terms of length, but maybe even in terms of structure?
You know, oddly, Madness came fairly smoothly. I wrote it in about 18 months, and it is not substantively different than it was at the beginning, except, you know, one would hope that it's a little better. It's a little cleaner. I think the big difference is I wrote chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter, knowing that I was going to cut the vast majority. I mean, I would say that I write, you know, maybe three times as much as I'm ever going to need, and that's my process. I'm never stuck with a blank page. You know, what I'm stuck with is 700 pages that I can't use. So, I mean, my agent is always just, you know, rolling her eyes at me and going, "My God, what have you done now?" when I send her these enormous packets. But the actual story did not change. The way that I was going to structure it from the beginning was I was going to start with the strong event the book starts with, which is a suicide attempt at the beginning, really to put people in the moment. And then I wanted to back up and go chronologically over the course of the development of, in this case, you know, the story being the development of my mental illness. And so I start in childhood. You know, I start in childhood, I cut to adolescence. I spend the bulk of the book in my adult years once I was diagnosed, because the point of the book is not, oh, look how crazy I am. The point of the book is you can survive mental illness. You know, you can live with this. You can be a writer. You can be a politician. You can be anything you want. But also, this is a serious thing that you need to take seriously. And so, stylistically, what I was trying to do was build a story that was going to carry you along in the same way that a novel would, but also affect you with strong points of dramatic incident and strong points of analysis that were going to carry you along, so that you had a sense of a building story, something coming to a closure at the end, something that was going to be resolved. And that's the thing about a memoir, because life is not at all resolved. And so when you're writing a memoir, you're essentially imposing a false structure on it. Your life does not have a narrative. Your life does not have, you know, these clear points where you learn these special things. And so that's the misleading aspect of memoir, is that, you know, if I look back at 34 years of my life, it certainly doesn't match the 300 pages of my memoir. Factually, everything is right there, but my own awareness of my life is not the same as what comes across in a book. That's the other thing about memoir. I'm sorry to keep going on, but
no,
this is
go
the
ahead.
Other thing about memoir that I say to people. When you're writing a memoir, you know, you have to get over the idea that absolutely everything you think, say, and do is terribly interesting, because most of what I say, think, and do is terribly dull. And if I'm going to write a book, I have to be very selective about what I say, because it's not about my life. It's not the story of my life. It's the story, in this case, of a mental illness. You know, it's, you know, my life, not interesting. This particular aspect of my life, a story that somebody else might get something out of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important to me when I'm reading a memoir, because so much of what many of the mistakes early memoirists make is in thinking that everything that ever happened was relevant and important because it seems relevant and important to them. And what I have to do as a memoirist is step away from everything that's relevant and important to me into everything that might be relevant and important to this story for the reader.
Interesting. Now, that's fascinating. This would also be a good time for you to read to us, would you?
I absolutely would. Let me grab this book.
And,
I'm still not used to seeing this book. You know, it freaks me out. This is the third time I've written a book, and I never really get used to actually having the book in my hands. In any case, this is from Madness, and I'll just jump in. Here's the hell of it. Madness doesn't announce itself. There isn't time to prepare for its coming. It shows up without calling and sits in your kitchen ashing in your plant. You ask how long it plans to stay. It shrugs its shoulders, gets up, and starts digging through the fridge. But even that implies some sort of lag time between the arrival of Madness and the actual experience of it. In the early years, it's like a switch flips on, and though only a moment before you were totally sane, suddenly you're totally mad. But as you learn to manage Madness, you begin to notice sooner that it's on its way. I lick my finger and hold it up to test the direction of the wind. Madness is in the air. I can smell it like I can smell snow. It's in the vicinity, though I don't know where or how long it will be until it comes. The trick is to shut the gate, throw sheets over the roses, go inside, lock all the windows and doors, and go down to the basement and sit on a chair to wait. Sometimes these preparations are enough. The locks on the windows and doors are tight. You've taken the medication faithfully. You've exercised to induce a sense of dopamine calm. You've put every lamp in the house in your office and flipped on the light box that mimics sunlight for people who get depressed in the winter. And the room is lit up as if with floodlights, and you're so hot you're working in your bra. You've stayed off the coffee. You've taken the supplements. You've worked starting at the same time and for the same length every day. You've interacted with human beings at least a few times this week. You've gotten yourself to the point where you can sleep in the normal time frame from night until morning, and your mornings are not a horrible struggle to stay out of bed, and you make the bed so you aren't tempted to get back in it. You check off the entries on the list that runs your life. But sometimes the system fails. Maybe it's a chemical shift in the brain that the medications don't block. Maybe it's a stressor in your life that you didn't expect. Maybe there is no reason, and you're just going mad for the hell of it, but you try not to think about that, because that would imply that no matter what you do, no matter how tightly you batten the hatches, madness can still get in.
Mm. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
That was Mario Hornbacher reading from Madness, A Bipolar Life, published by Houghton Mifflin. Wow. I'm curious, in terms of, you know, again, this is your second memoir, revealing yourself, revealing your life, revealing things in your life, perhaps even people in your life.
Sure.
That may or may not want to be revealed. How do you deal with that? Do you ask people, ask before you write? Do you wait till you have your draft before it's finished? When it's finished, before it goes to print, and say, hey, here's what I've done, read it and tell me what you think, and then adjust it if someone becomes perturbed? What do you do with that?
I'm very careful with the people in my books. I first of all, just gathering material for a memoir, I do it very much the same way I do an article. I interview people. And so I interview all of the people in my life who've known me at these various points, who've known me in various ways, in various settings, who can fact check for me and tell me, okay, this event did happen this way, this is what I actually said, this is where the records of this particular hospital stay are, et cetera, et cetera. When I'm dealing with friends, family, doctors, people like that, it is essential that I represent them as they are. And the way I do that is, could they recognize themselves? You know, so when I pass a piece of writing to my father and say, okay, here's the scene with us, what do you think? And he writes back and he says, that sounds just like me, that's exactly what happened, then
mm-hmm.
I've hit it.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody says, I don't remember that, I can't use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's just me remembering it, forget it. There are so many essential people in my life, especially with regards to this book. There are so many friends and family members who have been so close to me throughout my life dealing with mental illness and my life also as a writer, that I have a huge amount of material. And I also have a huge group of wonderful readers who can keep me very, very close to the source. I don't write things about people that I think will hurt them. I don't have any reason to. I don't feel a need to hurt people. There are a few characters in Madness who I don't have permission to be talking about them, and their names are changed because I'm no longer in touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are purposely not recognizable, really, to anyone but a very few people who knew them at a very specific time. And so I'm very, very careful to protect identities. And the people in my books whose actual names are used, they've given me legal permission. They've read all the material long before it's gone to print. So it's a very open process when it comes to the other characters in my book.
What about dialogue? How do you reconstruct dialogue? Because it's, you know, it's startling and very good in your book.
Thank you.
But what do you do with that?
I think memoir dialogue is a pretty tricky question. I have an easier time with it because I have a little bit of an eidetic memory for dialogue.
Mm.
It is, in fact, the easiest thing that I write, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. It comes mm-hmm. very naturally to mm-hmm. me, partly because I remember dialogue so well. Of course, the question with Madness is, you know, I do have all of these enormous holes in my memory, and you really might say, God, how could you remember that? Well, that's the nature of holes in your memory. You also have places that aren't a hole,
mm-hmm.
and much of what I remember are scenes with people in my life and conversations with people in my life. When I'm recording a conversation, almost every conversation that I have in there, I remember in a certain way, I double-check it with the person I had the conversation with. If I cannot access the person I had the conversation with, I don't use quotes in many instances. When I can access it, either by taped interview, hospital record, something like that, then I can quote directly. But I think ultimately when you're using dialogue in a memoir, what you're trying to do more than anything is speak in this person's pattern of speech, say the very, very truth of what they said in the way that they would have said it, whether it's flattering to me or not, you know, say what these people said, you know. I mean, I'm trained as a reporter. That was my first gig. And it's extremely important to me that I've got my quotes right. The problem with that is, of course, I can't go back and quote everyone. But to avoid basically editorializing my own conversations with people, I work very, very hard by going back through notebooks I have, diaries I have, because I write down what people say.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of hard material to work from. Beyond that, like I said, it's very much being true to the person and their style and even their speech pattern.
Mm. I like that you have so much back matter. You have about 20 pages at the back of the book with bibliography, with websites, with facts.
Yeah.
Was there ever any question of including all of that, or was that very much a part of the book from the start?
There was never a question of not including that. We did go through a draft. My editor and I thought, okay, well, let's give this a try. Let's try including all of this, for example, the research information, all those stats, and some citations and everything like that. We thought, okay, well, let's try including this in the body of the text. Let's see if we can work this through the way I did in Wasted, because Wasted is pretty heavily editorialized about the subject of eating disorders and bounces back and forth really between my own experience and a larger cultural view of eating disorders. So we tried that with this book. I wrote maybe another 100 pages, kind of cut it all in to see how it worked, and we just hated it. It was awful. And so we decided, no, we're going to go strictly with a personal story here. It was crucial to me. I mean, my original idea for this was really to make it clear to people that this was not just a one-off. This was not just one person's experience. This was not representative of, but a very common experience of people with bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And that it wasn't just, oh, this is me, Maria Hornbacher, and my fascinating story. This was, oh, God, this is a hell of a situation for a whole lot of people to be in. And also, this is a way that I need to, you know, as a reader, I want a reader to be thinking, this is a new way I need to think about this, and not a new way I need to think about Maria Hornbacher, because I am completely beside the point. The point is the subject. And so, yes, there was a question of including that in the main body of the book. Stylistically, it didn't work, you know. And so that's one of those places where if you're writing a memoir the way you should, which is to write it as a good book, you have to make some decisions that are kind of tough to take, you know, to take the subject matter and divvy it up somewhat from the actual story and keep it in the back matter. So that was the decision we ultimately made. I'm glad we did, because I think that back matter does kind of speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
I hope, you know, and I'm glad we made that decision, actually.
Mm. Yeah, I would think that it's going to be so helpful for people reading the book to come to the end and find all that.
Good.
Curious if then you write novels in a similar way. You said earlier that you, with your memoirs, you write, you know, three times as much as you need or thereabouts. What about novels? Or do you structure them differently? Are you much more sort of you know, following a plot, following an outline, not writing much more than you need? What's the difference?
No, it's worse. I write even more. I write even more on a novel. I think, I was sort of notorious for the drafts, the many, many drafts of The Center of Winter, which numbered in the thousands of pages, I have no doubt. I think with this new novel that I'm working on, obviously, when you first write a novel, you're writing your first novel, and that's a process of teaching yourself to write a novel, which is really not that much fun, harder than it looks. all of us have this idea of, oh, God, I think I'll write a novel, and I had that idea, and then, you know, somebody said, yeah, go ahead and write a novel, and I went, oh, shit. what am I going to do now? And so I really scrambled my way through it, and that was a tough job, doing that for my first novel. Having done it once, though, you know, there's a little bit of a trial by fire, and I have the way that I did it down now. You know, now I know what worked and what didn't work in writing my first novel, and so I'm going into this novel with considerably more, hopefully, skill and at least experience. So, yes, what I do, similar to what I do with the memoirs, is I'll start out, I'll have an idea, I'll start writing, I'll start doing a scene, I do a conversation, I do a little bit of dialogue, I do a little bit of setting, I do, you know, just kind of whatever comes to the top of my head, and I write on that for a while, maybe a day, maybe a couple weeks, and I have no idea what it is, and then suddenly it starts morphing into something, and I go, oh, this is not a novel, this is awful, you know, or I go, oh, this is not a novel, it's an essay, or my God, it's a novel, let's write a novel. So at that point, then I go through an extremely detailed outlining process, because I think a grave mistake that I have and some people do make with a novel is thinking that it will just tell itself to you.
Mm-hmm.
What it does instead is goes wandering off wherever the hell it wants. So you have to kind of chase it down, rein it in, make sure your characters aren't changing their mind. The other thing about writing a novel is that as structured as you can be going into it, unfortunately, characters really do have a life of their own. They really do just morph before your very eyes and tell you what they want to say. They're not going to say what you tell them to say. They're going to say what they want to say. The story's going to, suddenly someone will die in your book and you had no idea it was going to happen. You know, somebody has an affair and all of a sudden they run off to France. You have no idea, literally, what they're going to do. And that's part of the fun of it. It's also incredibly exasperating because you really feel like you're trying to herd cats. And it's a lot of fun. But yes, I go in with this very, 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 very careful, structured outline, especially for the book I'm working on right now, which is a historical novel, which is going to take a whole lot of outlining and research. I go in with a very careful outline, and once I have it, then I kind of set the characters free within it.
Interesting. Well, you know, you've been a delight, and we're at the end of our time, so you have to come back sometime. And
I'd love to.
And now I must go out and read your first novel.
Oh, I hope you like it.
Do you have any last words for the writers who are listening?
For the writers, the thing that keeps me going always is just write. Don't write well. It doesn't have to be good. Just sit down and write, because I know that I can walk around my desk 47 times a morning, not writing, and going, it's going to be bad. Well, who cares? You know, sit down and write it. Who cares if it's bad? Just write it.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That was Maria Hornbacher. Her book that we've been talking about is Madness, A Bipolar Life, published by Houghton Mifflin. She has a website, mariahornbacher.com, and lots of good stuff there. Oh, man, we're at the end of our time again. Of course, I let the end of the show quote drift to my briefcase. So I just reached back down and picked it up, and I'm going to read it to you if I can find it. Okay, here we are. And before I read it, I'm going to tell you again about my website, which is penonfire.com. You can find out who's going to be on the show. You can email me. You can get on the mailing list. Whatever. You can do lots there. And here's my quote. It's by Barack Obama, who said, "A good compromise, a good piece of legislation is like a good sentence or a good piece of music. Everybody can recognize it. They say, it works. It makes sense." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I will see you next time.
Here's to my lost youth, and here's to where it went, and here's to all my old friends, and the good times that we spent. Things will never be
like they were back then. Don't you know you can't go home again? And you can't go home again. And I once was a child on a summer's day, running with the wind, laughing all the way. And deep within my heart, someone says, hey friend, don't you know you can't go home again? You can't go home again. And I guess I've outlasted all my goals, and all my dreams are fading fast. I'm right down at the end of the rainbow. There's an old hand tinted photograph of me when I was young, 1963. Back when I was sure the sun was shining just for me, and it will never shine like it did back then. You know you can't go home again. You can't go home again. I guess I've outlasted all my heroes, and all my dreams are fading fast. And right down at the end of the rainbow, there's an old hand-tinted photograph of me and my lost youth, and me and my old dad, me and all my old friends, and the good times that we had. Friends will never be like they were back then. Don't you know you can't go home again? And you can't go home again.